5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Budget time is a little late this year, thanks to old mate COVID, which means everyone with an economic opinion is coming out of the woodwork. On the show over the last couple of weeks, we've spoken to a number of social service advocates and providers about the need to look after our most vulnerable, to get them working, to get them housing, and to keep our streets safe for everyone. But there's this new campaign by the Australia Institute, which has really got my goat. The think tank are urging the federal government to provide no tax cuts for working Aussies come budget time. As the executive director of the Australia Institute said overnight, cutting taxes for already wealthy Australians will undermine the long-term strength of our public services like healthcare and education, whilst doing very little to stimulate economic growth. So what annoys me about this push is that it only focuses on the top end of town. But it's the silent majority stuck in the middle, namely, and I hate this phrase, the middle class, who'll cop it. These people are not swimming in wealth. Many are just hardworking people trying to get ahead. They've probably been working for 20, 30, 40 years. They may have an investment property, but many now may have had things like their hours reduced at work. Everyone is feeling the squeeze. These are the people that will be punished by this type of thinking. The ones that the government will turn to keep the wheels of the economy going when welfare begins to be wound back next week. I'd love to hear your thoughts. What's happening in your backyard? How are your neighbours feeling? How are the mums feeling at school drop-off? What's the word at the pub? How are people feeling about the economy? Drop us a line at thewestlive@wanews.com.au. Today, we've got a big show coming up. We're speaking to the City of Perth's new chief executive about that race that everyone is very excited for come next month, the Lord Mayor. Also, we're speaking to a homeless advocate about what people like the CEO and the new Lord Mayor can do to fix the problem. We've got a massive show. Let's get into it.
The West Live. The West Live with Jenna Clark. Brought to you by Neds. Take it to the Neds level. Gamble responsibly. 1-800-858-858.
In just a few short weeks, the City of Perth will have a new Lord Mayor. It will be a fresh start for what has been a tumultuous time. Part of the city's recovery was also to appoint a brand new sparkly CEO, Michelle Reynolds. Michelle, welcome to the program. You've been in the role for just over a month now. What's been your first priority?
Well, hello everyone. My thank you. It does still feels new and shiny. My first priority really has been to get in and understand the business that the City of Perth undertakes, and really amazing how much work and how much effort goes into ensuring community has amenity, is safe, is all of the things that a local government does, plus being the capital city for this state. So it's really illuminating for me to see just exactly the scope of what is on offer in this city, which is amazing.
Yeah, for sure. I guess that's the beauty of the fact that things have been quite bad for quite some time. So I guess the future looks very bright. Now, for people that may not be familiar with your background, you came from Rottnest, right?
Yes. I was the executive director at Rottnest for a number of years. So, and that was actually, many people have asked me why I would leave Rottnest. Well, I mean, in some ways, they're very similar, Rottnest and the city, in that everyone has a view and everyone owns a little. It's in our DNA.
Of course, we
hold Rottnest dear and we hold our capital city precious to us all.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess one big issue that will be the focus for yourself and the new council when that is sworn in next month is this issue of trust. How do you plan to rebuild trust, not just with, you know, your ratepayers and the people that live in the city, but I guess for all West Australians, that we can put our trust in the City of Perth moving forward to turn it back into the jewel in the crown of our state?
Well, that's actually one of my key priorities, is obviously to support an incoming council to ensure they have all of the tools and everything they need to deliver for community. But from the administration's perspective in building that trust, looking at the inquiry into the City of Perth and really taking action against the recommendations and looking at making sure the foundations of good governance are really in place within this organisation.
What are some of those key findings out of that very expensive inquiry into the City of Perth? What are some of the recommendations that are high on your to-do list?
Well, there's a very large focus on audit and risk, and I think that's where my past experience also will really build on that to ensure that we look very carefully at what we do and how we do it, and we're fully transparent as well. I think actually that's one of my observations of the local government sector, is that the information is actually all there for community, and we just need to make sure it's in a form that everyone has access to and can easily understand.
Yeah, for sure. I guess one thing that has been probably the focus of a lot of people, probably specifically the media, is the safety within the City of Perth. Is the City of Perth still asking for state government support to restart the funding operation of Heat Shield to get more police on the beat throughout our city streets?
I think city safety is an issue for everyone, and I'm so pleased to see that the city and particularly police work so closely. And actually recently I've had several opportunities to go into our surveillance centre. So the city actually contributes about $8 million a year to city safety, and more recently topping that up with additional security services, and obviously the police are stepping in as well. So again, it's really about that collaboration, and when you see it on the ground, those city safe officers and everyone working together, it really does give you great confidence that we really have it. The front and centre is community safety, and that's for everyone.
What are some of the, I guess it's all well and good having new police on the beat and having more security. What are some of the interim measures you are taking at the moment to ensure that people want to come and visit the city, to go shopping, to grab a drink at night, to make it safer? Because I think a lot of people at this point in time would say, I don't want to go there after dark because of the homelessness issue, because of the violence issue. What can we do to either change the mindset or clean it up?
Well, there's a lot of things that can be done, and one of the things I've noticed having been to the surveillance centre is also people taking some personal responsibility. Yeah. So when you're with your mate and they're, you know, it's one of those rules, if your mate's a little bit under the weather, how are we looking out for everyone?
Indeed.
So I think as a community, government organisations, local, state, federal, all have a part to play, but equally community has a part to play to say, well, what do I need to make sure that I'm safe and others are safe? I think safety more broadly is also about activation of the city. So how do we really enthuse the day and nighttime economies? Because having a lot of people around makes people feel safe just within themselves anyway.
Yeah,
so there's been a few developments around lighting, around some infrastructure adjustments to really make sure all of those issues are addressed. So it's never a single response. It's a collective response, and it's one that looks at a whole range of different opportunities to invigorate, vitalise our city, and at the same time, keeping it safe.
For sure. Obviously, one thing that's probably been front and centre since you took over the role last month is the Lord Mayor race. What's your feeling on it? Have you met with the candidates? Are you allowed to meet with them? Like, what's the protocol there?
Well, we are in what we call a caretaker mode.
Sure.
So from that perspective, we really are looking at building everything we need to make sure the incoming elected members have everything they need. I've been watching from a distance. It's most appropriate, I think, that I maintain that distance for the time being. But I can say I'm very impressed with the calibre and the enthusiasm of all of the candidates who are running. And we really can't wait. We are impatient to get going.
Yeah, for sure. October 18 can't come quick enough.
Exactly.
Interestingly, there's just one specific proposal that I guess has really sparked an interest for me is one of the candidates, Di Bain. She's proposed for a committee to decide on conflicts of interest, which anyone that's followed the council closely over the past couple of years would know that that's a bit of an issue. Is that even feasible? Will her ideas for a conflicts committee that she said would establish a process for managing all conflicts be best practice for governance? Or will this slow down the council decision-making process?
Well, I think conflicts of interest were really at the part of the inquiry into the City of Perth, and I think anything that gives transparency to community is great. I think anything that also enables that clarity for elected members, because it is a very complex space that we operate in. And I know, being recently introduced to all of this, is that there are overlays of rules and regulations and policies, and so I think clarity for all would be wonderful.
So would you like to see almost like a subcommittee, just to make sure that there is a lens of credibility over all decisions that are being made?
Well, there is already, and so what I would hope is any good suggestions on ensuring that is robust, and that if there's any improvements to be made, then absolutely.
Now, we spoke about Rottnest before. You turned that into a shining light of somewhere where people want to visit. Are you taking anything that you've learnt from there and applying it to the City of Perth? How can you encourage more people to get into the city and be a tourist in our own backyard?
Oh, and, you know, that was my learning for Rottnest as well, is that we have treasures all around us. And I think, although COVID has been devastating and touched most of us, that some of our learning is how very fortunate we are. I think my learnings from Rottnest were very much about everyone has a view and you have to hear it, and that being open to comments, feedback, criticisms is critical if you want to really look at your business objectively. I also think my other major learning was view the world from the visitor's perspective or the business's perspective or the resident's perspective, because then you truly understand what it feels like. So listening and hearing people about how things can be done. And my final learning was be open to new ideas. I think, you know, the opportunity to have two new developments in 30 years on the island, a new ferry operator, you know, significant funding from state and Commonwealth government, and then being able to pivot in and become a quarantine facility for West Australians was, you know, really showed me that when you've got a great organisation, much can be achieved.
Indeed. Homelessness, it's an issue that has plagued the city for the past couple of months, if not years. What's your take on the situation currently and the fact that some of the Lord Mayors would like to come in to really fix the issue either by force or by virtue and basically make sure that we are leading the charge in how to almost cure homelessness in around Australia? What's your take? Because I guess you're on the front line of this right now.
Yes, and I've also taken the opportunity to really participate in what the city is actually doing to support homelessness and rough sleepers. And again, this is a state issue, but like most really important things, it needs collaboration. And I'm so pleased to see that the city does work so very closely with service providers, state government, and people on the ground, because I think what I really think is good about this debate and discussion is that it's bringing it to everyone's attention, and there is such a groundswell of goodwill and enthusiasm to do something and really make a difference. So I am really excited to be part of something that could make that difference.
For sure. What a business. Have you decided to, you know, have you been, whilst you've been in the role, have you been wandering around the city chatting to residents and to business owners and things like that? What are you hearing on the ground about how they're feeling? Obviously, COVID is one specific area that is probably completely out of your realm, but how are they feeling about, you know, the future of the City of Perth?
Well, do you know, recently I went to a function, Reignite Perth, and I was so impressed because everyone in the room there was a palpable emotion about loving our city. And I felt that maybe it was sometimes when things aren't so good, that's what actually reminds you of what we cherish the most. And really, everyone in that room was so committed to improving the city, making it an exemplar across the nation and beyond. And so really an opportunity for us all to talk it up, to know how good we have it, and to actually do something positive. So my assessment from the businesses, and really everyone is feeling the pain, so that's obviously needs to be acknowledged. But I think the goodwill and the enthusiasm is what we need to tap into, and that's what will see us through this really challenging period.
Do you think it's time just to be completely fearless and throw out the rule book when it comes to things like the way that we conduct, our city? We just have to, whatever idea comes up, you just have to give it some credence and see if it's got any legs?
Oh, I love being a little bit provocative. And but absolutely. I mean, if you do things the same, things will stay the same.
Yeah.
So that was my learning, as I said, from Rottnest is, sometimes you've got to shake it up a little bit. And the potential of this city, and actually even what we have now, is really stellar. So I think, again, being open to all opportunities and to be prepared to really embrace some change is great. Mm. And I think we're ready for it.
Absolutely. I think you will definitely all fall in behind you once that new council and Lord Mayor get there. One final thing I have to bring up with you, Michelle, is that my colleague, Sarah Steger, spends a lot of time in the city. She's a court reporter. She sent a photo yesterday about for City of Perth parking, and there's bays dedicated to females only. Can you describe this for me? Is this a safety measure or because we're just really bad drivers?
Well, I would challenge our really bad driver. Who said that? the female only. Now, that's new to me, and it sounds like a very interesting initiative. So I might have to check that one out and see if I can get some particularly good parking.
Look, do you think that it's probably a safety mechanism to ensure that the women park closer to the exits and entry points of parking bays and things like that?
Possibly, and if so, that's terrific. I have a 17-year-old daughter, and I, always say, give her advice on how to look after her personal safety. Mm. And any initiative that assists people being safe, I think, has to be celebrated and recognised. So, sounds really good.
Speaking of parking, I kind of enjoyed coming into the city during COVID when there was no one of those pesky parking inspectors roaming around. Could we see a reduction in paid parking in the City of Perth to encourage more people to come in and enjoy it?
Well, this is something I think the incoming councillors, elected members, will be really wanting to explore. Mm. And these are the levers that can revitalise our city. So, again, another reason why we're so excited and really looking forward to the elected members starting so we can have these conversations and work out how and what we can do to get more people into our city.
Mm, for sure. I've just finally, Michelle Reynolds, you are the Chief Executive for the City of Perth. You've got to give a shout out to one of your favourite coffee shops, restaurants, bars. What are you enjoying in the city at the moment?
Well, I have to say the state building is pretty impressive.
I would like to live there.
Oh, me too. I wonder. And I have a Telegram coffee in front of me and it's superb.
Lovely. Well, look, we look forward to seeing what you and the new Lord Mayor and the council get up to in the future. CEO for the City of Perth, Michelle Reynolds, thank you so very much for your time.
Thank you.
Coming up, the saying, an apple a day. Well, now there's some fascinating new research that proves not all apples are equal. And if you're a West Aussie, there's a WA-grown variety that's the healthiest in the world. Stick around, I'll have all the details later in the show. But first, 15 homeless people have died on the streets of Perth since July. That was the word in the weekend papers. The rate of Aboriginal homelessness is 13 times higher than that of non-Indigenous people. This is a crisis and an area that Dr. Betsy Buchanan has been working in for more than 3 decades. Her tireless campaigning in this area led her to being inducted into the WA Women's Hall of Fame, and she joins me now. Betsy, you wrote a very powerful opinion piece in the West Australian yesterday. What more can be done to house the homeless in Western Australia?
Well, at the moment, the Department of Communities have a lot of empty houses, and that's also in the regions. They could put some of the crisis people, often of whom have very ill children or have been victims of severe domestic violence, into them as a temporary measure to save lives. But also, the government do have funds to do what's called spot purchase. Mm-hmm. And at the moment, the prices of houses in places, even like Albany, where we've got a chronic housing need for Aboriginal people, are much cheaper than they previously were. there would be enough money in the spot purchase fund, or it could be increased. Maybe some of the money that was given for maintenance could be diverted into it to buy up houses. That would save us the torturous bureaucracy, which Aboriginal people can't really make their way through often, and enable them to be, so to speak, crisis housing. Sometimes it may have to be for longer than 12 months, just to get families back on their feet, because most people we deal with have been through extreme trauma, mm-hmm. including domestic violence. Sometimes their children have been very traumatised. Mm-hmm. They've had suicides, they've had homicides. There's a lot of trauma underlying most Aboriginal homelessness, and the government just seemed to have abandoned those families.
Betsy, are you encouraged by the fact that we have been profiling, you know, these shanty towns that are popping up around our CBD to really highlight the issue that Aboriginal West Australians are facing?
Look, I'd like to say something about the West Australian. In the whole time that I've been working, they have always been the ones that have stepped forward to try and draw attention to what was going on, both in terms of homelessness and child abuse. When we had the campaigns under Mr. Richard Court, Section 64, the West did multiple articles. Mm. Colleen Egan did multiple articles on the strikes, and we've always had support from the West, and we're getting it now, to try and draw attention to what's happening with Aboriginal families, that they're being discriminated against, that they can't respond to the sort of society that we've created, because the services that are set up don't really listen to them or meet their needs, and they must be accompanied by housing. It's pointless to tell a traumatised family, look, we'll counsel you, we'll give you mental health help, we'll give you suicide prevention strategies, if you don't have a house, because they just can't access them. The money would be much better spent on spot purchase. I mean, they could solve the housing problem within a few months. They've got an efficient bureaucracy. It's just that, in fact, Department of Communities, the housing branch, are very efficient and very responsive. It's just that all their energy is now being put into evicting people and also making it extremely hard for them to apply again.
When you say evicting people, what do you mean? Who are they evicting at this point in time, considering there's a moratorium on evictions?
Well, I'll give you an example of a family we're working with at the moment. She's a young woman with five children of her own who's been subject to quite horrific violence, domestic violence. Her family have had a lot of intergenerational trauma, so what used to be the Department of Communities have just placed two wards of the state with her, so she's got seven children. The department are in the middle of putting huge amount of energy into evicting her. They've taken her back and forward to court, causing her fear and trauma. The amount of energy and money that's going into trying to make seven children homeless, including two of that in the care of the state, I think we have to get across to the public, and I think that the newspaper are trying to do that, how grave that behaviour is, considering their rhetoric is completely in another different direction.
Yeah. It's really interesting because I was just speaking to the City of Perth Chief Executive Michelle Reynolds, and she sort of echoes the sentiment that there is a lot of community, there's a groundswell of community support to ensure that homelessness of all forms is eradicated moving forward. I guess the community support is there. How do we move the needle with this when it comes to bureaucracy and the government?
How we move the needle is that the government need to get together and change immediately their policies towards Aboriginal families and the Department of Communities. You'd have to say at the moment it's a human rights and policy disaster. Mm-hmm. They could solve it by making a decision to buy spot purchase housing. They have the legal means to do that, and they do have the money. At a time when the houses are so cheap, they could buy dozens of those houses and house those families. There's nothing a Lord Mayor can do unless they have an impact on the Department of Communities, because the Department of Communities are making a constant stream of people homeless, hundreds a year. So every time any so-called solution is put up, hundreds more homeless people will follow. And just the example of what I gave you, where are those seven children going to go? And the mother, the traumatised mother, she'll join the ranks of the homeless, and after her there'll be another one. And then I think last year the government evicted, I think it was 450 or maybe even close to 500 families. The figures are underestimated because a lot of people leave because they're told they have to hand their keys in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, I mean, how can – it's a rhetoric that's basically in a void at the moment.
Yeah.
How can they make any difference at all when a government are constantly creating the homeless, not just evicting them but not allowing – once you get evicted, you can be told you're never to be housed again. So, for example, that woman that I've described could be put on the never-to-be-housed-again list for the next decade.
Mm-hmm.
So her children will definitely all be removed. And she'll be given a debt, which would have been caused by her violent, very violent first partner.
Mm-hmm.
It could be as much as $20,000, and she would have to pay that back before they would even look at taking an application for her.
God. And therein lies the spiral, right? You're homeless, you can't get a job, you're probably struggling on whatever minimum welfare you've got. So that circle of horror just continues.
It's a circle of horror in the sense the mothers become very despairing, and uncharacteristically, they sometimes turn to alcohol and drugs because they lose all hope. When you can see that young mother struggling like mad, she's gone back and forth to court, she's agreed to take some children who are in the care of the CEO because she's such a responsible person.
Mm-hmm.
If they succeed in evicting her, which they are most determined to do, and as I said, they put a huge amount of resources into it, they will destroy her. I mean, I've seen so many lives destroyed. All those waves of evictions have led to deaths, suicides, imprisonment, removal of children. And the other thing that people won't face, and certainly the mayor candidates haven't really touched on it, when children are abused, evicted, and thousands of them have been, the risk of them being abused is massive because they've got nowhere to go, so they crowd into houses. They've got no real status in that house.
Mm.
And their exposure to trauma and abuse is enormous.
Absolutely. And today you'll be hosting Shelter WA's Lord Mayor Forum, where you'll talk about all of these issues. What are you hoping to hear? What campaign, what candidate would have, what message are you hoping to hear from the candidate that you will back?
Well, some understanding of the issues would help. I don't think they're the sorts of people who have really got an understanding of
any lived experience.
I mean, even though we've got an ex-magistrate and the magistrates do the evictions, but that magistrate, I'm not criticising him personally at all, but he was in the children's court. But his colleagues, his fellow magistrates, would have presided over thousands of evictions. You have to go through the magistrate court. If the department can't frighten the people out of the houses first, and they do try to avoid the scrutiny of the court approved the evictions. And because the legislation was tightened under Mr. Barnett's government to make it very easy to evict people, the magistrate's hands are basically tied. And though they try very hard to prevent children being evicted, they still have to evict them.
Yeah.
So no one who's been a magistrate should ever say, how did this happen? Because magistrates are the instruments of evicting.
Yeah, for sure. Have you spoken, speaking of the opposition now, have you spoken with anyone in that party about their plans? Should they come hell or high water win the election in March? Will they overturn Mr. Barnett's...
They brought it in. I am having to say definitely for balance that this present government have followed it. So they have taken their policies and kept using them.
Mm-hmm.
The opposition do have a Minister for Homelessness,
mm-hmm.
and he has objected to them selling so many houses. But see, when they were in government, they sold thousands of houses.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they've done nothing but denude the public housing stock. But the even worse thing for Aboriginal people, they virtually made it impossible for them to get into public housing. And if they do, they're totally insecure because they can be evicted so quickly, and it's become entrenched into government policy to evict Aboriginal people and then to abandon them. the Department of Child Protection, as they were, are supposed to be attending every eviction where there's children, and there almost always are children and often a lot of children, but they just don't do it because if you look at what they're being faced with, how can they help that family when their whole basis of shelter's been removed? Yeah. They don't control houses. They're basically asking support agencies to do the impossible, to help people who are homeless and you can't. Yeah. I mean, that's the only reason I brought in personal issues in my piece, that you cannot be healed if you're homeless. The fear, the violence, the anxiety, the sense of stigma and loss of self-esteem is so deep-seated. I mean, those things happen where you've been abused anyway, and look how many Aboriginal people have been abused.
Yeah.
The Royal Commission documented thousands of cases, and that's in our state, and the government know that. They're supposed to be responsible for healing the wounds of the Royal Commission, and they still keep evicting people. Most of those people they've evicted have been victims of abuse in their family.
It's just, it's such a very heavy topic. And Dr. Betsy Buchanan from Day Dawn Advocacy Centre and How's the Homeless Representative, I really appreciate you joining us and sharing your very personal story yesterday. We will keep an eye on, I guess, the forum today, and then let's also keep in touch to ensure that we keep that community groundswell for support of Aboriginal people going.
Thank you very much for your time.
Joining me now is Peter Spencer. He's the dad of Stephen Spencer, a two-time Afghanistan war veteran who is now stranded in Abu Dhabi with his family. He's penned a very powerful open letter to his country asking, since when do Aussies leave mates behind? There is a picture of him on the front page of today's paper in his fatigues, and his dad, Peter, is on the line. Peter, thank you so very much for joining us. How are the family holding up?
Look, it's been extremely frustrating. It's taken a heavy toll on Stephen and his family. Two children, one who turned 17 yesterday, and a son and a daughter, 13. They haven't been in the classroom at school since the 23rd of March this year. So that's just one aspect of it. But just the unknown and the uncertainty and both the Australian federal government and Mark McGowan here, there's been no help whatsoever. It's been extremely disappointing. And when you feel, when you know your son, what he's done in the army over two trips to Afghanistan and East Timor and serving the country for 10 years, it's a slap in the face. And I'm just extremely disappointed the way it's been handled. The politicians on both sides have done nothing to help. All they're keen on is point scoring, and basically it's just lip service, and really disappointed with the way it's been handled by the government, both here and federally.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess we've heard stories about people trying to, Aussies just trying to come home for the last couple of months. Your son and his wife and their two lovely children have been trying to get home since July, and they've now been told they can't get a flight until January. Is that what finally pushed Stephen to the point of having to write an open letter to us all back here?
Yes, that's correct. That's what tipped him over the edge there in that regard, and just felt that he just needed to do that to try and explain his or their plight, but not only their situation. There's many others who are in a similar situation or a lot worse than they are, and he acknowledges that. An example of a family at Heathrow Airport, children aged 14, 11 and 1. My daughter-in-law is aware of that family. Three nights sleeping at Heathrow Airport with a one-year-old. And, you just think, surely Australia can do better than that. And so it's really, it's sort of rocked us, to be honest, yes.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess you here back home, you've probably been trying to do all that you can. What are you hearing from, I guess, trying to just call government officials, trying to call airlines? What type of response are you getting?
Look, I've been in touch with Stephen Irons' office, the federal member for Canning, and I've been dealing with a gentleman there by the name of David Hobbs. And look, David has been doing everything he possibly can, and we have appreciated his efforts, as does Stephen and his family. But in the end, the cats that we have here in Western Australia, and it just it's simply not going to get people home. The number that they talk about of 25,000, talking to Kate Stevens' wife last night on the phone, the realistic figures are somewhere around 150,000.
Wow.
So increasing flights by a minimal amount, in the end, it's really just lip service and politicians just hoping it'll all go away. Mm. But it's not until they take responsibility and show for the first time some compassion for these people who have been stranded, and they are Australians who deserve a little bit better than that. I mean, we're enjoying the comforts and the politicians of what we have at home here, whereas people, you know, far worse off than Stephen and Kate and his family, just financially in massive trouble, nowhere to call home, and just wondering what's the next 6 to 12 months going to look like.
Absolutely. I guess in terms of what would also be an absolute slap in the face is that your son Stephen, he's done 2 tours of Afghanistan, he's served his country the highest honour that he could, and then to be told or to have an idea floated last week that, you know, if they do get home, you're going to go straight to detention centre on Christmas Island. What's your take on that?
Knowing Steve, and obviously I think he'd find that a little bit better than spending 14 days locked up in a hotel room. But, you know, the thing is, Mark McGowan speaks about that sort of thing. I'd love to know how he would feel if that was his family having to go there. You know, they just say these things and think, oh, yeah, people can do it. Well, what about you thinking about having to put your family through that? Would you be prepared to do that? I'd just love to be able to get face-to-face with him for about 5 minutes and have a real good chat to him about it. But, you know, I'm actually disgusted with the way they've handled it and the state government here and the caps they've put in place. I won't say any more, Jen. I'm sort of at boiling point, but I just need to take a step back at the moment.
Of course. Just one final question for you, Peter. I guess the cost of trying to get Stephen and his wife and the 2 kids home. What's the ballpark that they're hearing from airlines and I guess for hotel quarantine?
Yeah, about 40,000 to 50,000.
Wow.
And again, that's just sort of because you know, it was once business flight, a business airfares, and then first class. And, I mean, that's talk. Yeah, they expect people, oh, well, haven't you got that sort of money to just be able to bring your family home? They're living in la-la land, some of these politicians, and they need to have a real good look at themselves and show at long last some compassion that they haven't shown Australian citizens throughout this journey. Because a lot of people do not have that sort of money to be able to just say, oh, yeah, I'll bring my family home with that. They haven't got it. But for some reason, politicians just don't understand that, Jenna.
No, I think your frustration speaks to a lot of us, Pete, and we really appreciate you spreading the word, and we really appreciate your son, Stephen, writing that letter so we all really understand the plight of Aussies stranded overseas. We'll keep on this story, but thank you so very much for joining us. You take care and best to the family.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate you giving me the time. Thank you for that.
You take care.
The West Live. Making news.
Morning, Matt Tinney. Well, you've just heard we've spoken to that poor digger's dad. What an absolute nightmare situation for them. What's the latest?
Yeah, you could hear the emotion in his voice, couldn't you? So we have this digger and his family stranded overseas. They want to come home to Australia. They've been trying to get home since July. Now they're being told the first flight they can get back on is January, and that flight will cost $6,000 for each of them, so $24,000. Then they've got hotel quarantine on top of that.
Yeah.
This is something we'll be following up today and questioning the government on to see if we can get any movement on this. But, of course, it all comes down to those caps and those caps are in place because it keeps the hotel quarantine system running smoothly. This is what the government says, and also so that we don't have the sort of outbreaks of the virus that we've seen in Melbourne, where the hotel quarantine system absolutely broke and was a disaster over there.
Oh, it's a bit of an absolute mess right now. Speaking of messes, there's something going on in Mosman Park. A historic case could be cracked finally.
Yeah, some new clues have come out. I don't know if you remember this one, a rape in Mosman Park. A 19-year-old nanny was attacked. She was looking after a 2-year-old child back in 2010. Police have now revealed the attacker had decaying yellow teeth and was wearing a mosquito or fly net when he knocked on the front door in Mosman Park. He was holding some yellow lilies. Police have also revealed the rapist stole the victim's diary and her phone and later made a phone call to the parents of the child she'd been looking after, telling them not to report the crime. So some chilling new details that have come out. Police believe somebody knows who this person is, and they say 10 years on, it's not too late to come forward.
Indeed. Last night, we're all tuned into Flashpoint to watch the Lord Mayor debate before, I guess, voting has already opened. How did that go last night? Who was the standout?
Well, it was very, very interesting. I mean, unsurprisingly, Basil Zemplis and Mark Gibson with their TV background really shone through in that format last night, I think. The seven candidates were quizzed on things like homelessness, entertainment in the city. They were quizzed on their one big idea that would change the face of Perth. Very interesting ideas in there. We had some people like Basil suggesting, you know, a mining show on Langley Park. Then we had Tim Schwash saying solving homelessness. That would be something that would put Perth on the map. People would come here and ask us how we did it. So people had interesting takes on that question. We've got just over 3 weeks to go until this election. I don't think we've seen a local government election like this. You know, a TV debate, you know, you've had the West Live debate, so much exposure and so much interest and fighting over a few thousand votes.
I know.
So it'll be very interesting to see how it falls, because, of course, businesses get double the votes that residents do. Some of the candidates have obviously been targeting residents more, some more in the business community, and you can tell in their policies they're pitching more to the business community. So this race is really heating up now, that's for sure.
Indeed. Matt Tinney from Sunrise, we'll see you on air tomorrow, and then shortly after you'll join us on the West Live. You have a lovely day.
You too. Have a great one, Jenna.
Thanks, Maddie. Coming up, remember the Albany police officer attempting a virtual Everest climb on Bluff Knoll? Well, how did she go? Ben O'Shea with all the details shortly. But first, let's talk apples, because apparently we here in WA have the world's healthiest ones right here in our very own backyard. Joining me now is one of the scientists behind this research, Dr. Nikki Bondono. What is so good about WA apples?
Hi, Jenna. Well, our research has shown that WA apples have a really high polyphenol content.
Right.
And polyphenols are compounds that are great for our health. They help prevent heart disease and cancer. So great that they're really high in apples here in WA.
Tell us about, is it a specific, is it a Pink Lady? Is it a Granny Smith? Is it one of those really X-y Bravos? Or is it a hybrid of all of them?
We actually had a look at 91 different apple varieties that are here in WA.
Mm-hmm.
And I can tell you that the ones with the highest polyphenol content are the Pink Lady apples and the Bravo apples.
Interesting. So what are some of the health benefits to the Pink Lady and the Bravo?
Well, they're great for the health of our blood vessels. There's evidence that shows that they can reduce blood pressure, reduce inflammation, and all of these things will help lower our risk of both heart disease and cancer.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of, I guess, the Pink Lady was created here in WA, as was the Bravo. Do you think we're going to see agronomists and scientists maybe try to make a next generation apple to combine the two and then make it a super duper apple moving forward?
Well, the Bravo apple was actually one that was developed specifically for its health benefits. So it's a hybrid apple developed here in WA.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the purposes of our study was to have a look at whether the polyphenol content of apples differs by the variety of apples, so whether there's a genetic component, and that will pave the way for developing really high healthy apples that may be very particularly healthy.
Are we eating a lot of apples? Are we eating enough? I feel it's kind of like the it's the little black dress of the fruit world. You always know it's there and it's something that you can grab really easily, but I feel that sometimes other fruits may be popping up in popularity. Are we getting enough apple intake here in WA?
Well, apples are one of the most highly consumed fruits worldwide. I think that's because they're available all year round. A lot of other fruits, you know, they're more seasonal than apples. But we can definitely increase our apple consumption. I think if we're aiming for an apple a day, you know the old saying, an apple a day keeps the doctor away. Well, I think there is something behind that. So if we all aim to have an apple a day, then we could really be reducing our risk of all sorts of diseases.
Fantastic. Now, if we're heading to the supermarket today, we should be focusing on Pink Lady and Bravo, which are both grown here in WA. I do like a Granny Smith. Am I still going to get those health benefits, or do I need to focus more on the red apple varieties?
They're definitely at a higher concentration in the red apples. So one of the polyphenols that we look at it's called anthocyanin. Mm-hmm. That actually is responsible for giving the apple its red colour. Right. So the more red an apple, the more anthocyanins it contains.
Good to know. Well, look, thank you so very much for helping me with my shopping list. And it was great to read that WA apples are really leading the charge. I look forward to our farmers down south when they get those fruits off the trees, sending them over around the world to enjoy all of our goodness. Dr. Nikki Bondono from Edith Cowan University, thank you so very much for joining us.
Thanks, Jenna.
We are pretty excited here at the West Live because Ned's have recently jumped on board as a proud sponsor. We're excited to take it to the Ned's level this spring carnival, if this weather ever finds up. Ned's is where betting meets innovation and fun, which is why they have launched a tool to help you find your perfect match. Filter form filters, racing form fast, all based on your preferences. It is Ned's level. You simply select your preferences and filter form does the rest. For example, you can filter last start winners, one at the track, even an odds range. I use filter form for everything, specifically last night what I wanted to watch on Netflix. Download the Neds app today and take it to the Neds level. Remember to gamble responsibly, call 1-800-858-858.
Wild West.
Ben O'Shea, I have been thinking about this woman that was climbing Bluff Knoll 14 times ever since we mentioned it last week. Is she okay?
She survived. Ah. This Albany detective senior constable, Kylie Bell, we spoke last week and said that she was going to attempt a virtual Everest.
Yes.
So that's basically going up and down Bluff Knoll 14 times nonstop, which is the equivalent of climbing Everest. And she's an ultra marathon runner in her spare time, and she was doing it to raise money for the Albany Women's Centre and the Animal Protection Society of WA. And so this was last Thursday. She kicked off at 4 a.m. And she had a target time of 30 hours to do it 14 times. Like, I think it would take me 30 hours to do it once.
Yes.
And I'm pleased to report, not only did she complete the 14 ascents of Bluff Knoll, she did it in quicker than she expected. She did it in 29 hours and
wow.
20 minutes.
That is incredible. Now, was she raising funds for something or awareness for some type of organisation?
Yeah, she definitely was. So for the Albany Women's Centre and the Animal Protection Society of WA, you can head to her Facebook page, Running Pink, and you can still make a donation there. And the thing I like, they spoke to her down at the Albany Advertiser afterwards, and they, you know, how is she doing? And she goes, oh, the calves are a little sore. Oh. That was it.
Kyles, you're amazing if you're listening. Well done. I don't think, like you say, I think it would take me 29 hours just to make it up one before even coming down. Now, two Jero blokes, your favourite neck of the woods, what have they gotten up to in our favourite little Midwest town?
So they've tried to carjack a bloke on a motorised scooter. So police are going to allege that these two fellows, a 23-year-old and a 34-year-old, were driving along in a Holden Astra when they pulled alongside this bloke on the scooter and ran him off the road. Then they allegedly got out of the car, pushed him off the scooter, and then they tried to drive off with the scooter. For whatever reason, that wasn't successful. They've taken his keys and then driven off. And the police are going to allege that the victim and his assailants were known to each other. So there might be more to this story, but we'll have to wait until they front the Geraldton Magistrates Court next month to find out what that story exactly is.
Absolute bozos. Well, look, if anyone's on the Gero Court watch list, it's definitely you, and I look forward to that report next month. Ben O'Shea, you stay warm and dry out there, and we'll chat to you in the Wild West on the West Live tomorrow.
I'll talk to you tomorrow.
That's it for me. Tune in at 8:45 tomorrow over on thewest.com.au/live and also over on Perth Now. Or you can catch up on a replay of today's episode of The West Live at 12:30 over on The West and Perth Now. Or download the podcast. Have a lovely Tuesday. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to The West Live with Jenna Clark. Brought to you by Neds. Take it to the Neds level. Gamble responsibly. 1-800-858-858. If the story behind the story matters to you, then you can count on thewest.com.au to deliver.
It's the podcast that has Australia captivated. Claremont, The Trial. We take you inside the courtroom with over 3 million downloads already. Catch up on Claremont The Trial at thewest.com.au or where you get your podcasts.